Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and this is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, March 15th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast for today, this coming from KCRG. The headline is, Quieter Into the Week, Colder St. Patrick's Day on the Way. No major storm systems are coming soon, but that doesn't mean our weather will be without any changes. We'll be feeling the influence of an area of high pressure today that will be centered off to our west as yesterday's storm system moves well away from the region. A few leftover clouds may be found in the south early today, but those will clear out in the first couple of hours of the day. Temperatures will start out in the 30s, but widespread sunshine and lack of a real change in our air mass means we'll wind up only a couple of degrees cooler than yesterday in many cases. That translates to highs in the mid to upper 50s, with some low 60s possible in the south. Things will be a bit breezy during the daytime hours, but likely with lower gusts than we saw yesterday. Those winds will gradually shift to a bit more of a westerly direction this evening and southwesterly tonight. This keeps things from cooling off too much, with lows in the upper 30s again likely to start off Saturday morning. A cold front will be the main driver of our weather for the rest of the weekend, and it moves through during the morning hours. Some additional cloud cover comes with it, and winds will shift to the northwest and become somewhat gusty. While that usually means colder air is coming, the chilly temperatures with this one will lag a bit behind the front. Highs will reach the mid to upper 50s. The coldest temperatures fall on Sunday into Monday, when the core of this Canadian air mass settles into the region. Temperatures will fall below normal for the first time this month, with highs only making it toward the upper 30s to low 40s. Wind chill values will probably only recover to the upper 20s to low 30s during the afternoon on Sunday and Monday, making for a couple of very chilly days amid blustery conditions. This does affect St. Patrick's Day plans on Sunday. You'll want to dress warmly if you're headed out and about to celebrate the day. Looking at next week, things start to turn around as soon as Tuesday next week, when temperatures will likely be around 10 degrees warmer than on Monday. That temperature range holds for the rest of the work week, with 50s common on each day. There will be a modest downturn in temperature again by the end of next week, as our weather pattern generally turns a bit more active. We currently have a chance of showers forecast for Thursday, though some other disturbances will be moving near the region into next weekend. If their track changes a bit, this could put us more in line for additional precipitation chances. Now, turning to the front page of today's Courier, the headline on the top story is, Judge Denies Trump Case Dismissal. Former President Accused of Retaining Sensitive Information. This information comes to the Courier by way of the Associated Press. Fort Pierce, Florida. A federal judge rejected a bid by Donald Trump to throw out his classified documents criminal case Thursday and appeared skeptical during hours of arguments of a separate effort to scuttle the prosecution ahead of trial. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon issued a two-page order saying the Trump team raised, quote, various arguments warranting serious consideration, but a dismissal of charges was not merited. Cannon, who was nominated to the bench by Trump, made clear during more than 3.5 hours of arguments that she was reluctant to dismiss one of the four criminal cases against the 2024 presumptive Republican presidential nominee. She said at one point that it would be, quote, quite an extraordinary step to strike down an Espionage Act statute that underpins the bulk of the felony counts against Trump, but that his lawyers contend is unconstitutionally vague. As Trump looked on in the courtroom, his attorneys pressed Cannon to throw out the case, arguing he was legally entitled to keep the sensitive records he is charged with illegally retaining after he left the White House. His lawyers say the Presidential Records Act gave him the authority to designate the records he took with him to his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida as personal property. Prosecutors countered that those records were clearly presidential, not personal, and included top-secret information and documents related to nuclear programs and the military capabilities of the U.S. and foreign countries. Cannon's ruling covered only the Espionage Act arguments. A separate motion argued Thursday about whether Trump was entitled under the Presidential Records Act to retain the documents remains pending, but the judge also seemed disinclined to throw out the case on those grounds, too. Quote, "It's difficult to see how this gets you to the dismissal of an indictment," she told a Trump lawyer at one point. The hearing was the second this month in the case in Florida, which unfolded slowly in the courts since prosecutors first brought charges last June. Cannon heard arguments March 1st on when to schedule a trial date, but has yet to announce one and gave no indication Thursday on when she might do so. Prosecutors have pressed the judge to set a date for this summer. Trump's lawyers hope to put it off until after the election. The 1978 statute, known as the Presidential Records Act, requires presidential documents to be turned over to the National Archives and Records Administration, though former presidents may retain notes and papers created for purely personal reasons. Trump's lawyers contend that he was free under that law to do with the records as he pleased. Quote, "He had original classification authority," said defense lawyer Todd Blanche. "He had the authority to do whatever he thought was appropriate with his records," unquote. Prosecutors assert the files Trump is charged with possessing are presidential records, not personal ones, and the statute was never meant to permit presidents to retain classified and top-secret documents like those that were kept at Mar-a-Lago. Quote, "The documents charged in the indictment are not personal records, period," said David Harbach, a member of Special Counsel Jack Smith's team. Quote, "They are nowhere close to it under the definition of the Presidential Records Act," unquote. Trump's lawyers also challenged as overly vague a statute that makes it a crime to have unauthorized retention of national defense information, a charge that forms the basis of 32 of the 40 felony counts against Trump in the case. Defense lawyer Emil Bove said ambiguity in the statute permits what he called selective enforcement by the Justice Department, leading to Trump being charged, but enabling others to avoid prosecution. Bove suggested a recent report by Special Counsel Robert Hur that criticized President Joe Biden's handling of classified information, did not recommend charges, proved his point about the lack of clarity. Jay Bratt, another prosecutor with Smith's team, disputed that there was anything unclear about the law, and Cannon pointedly noted that striking down a statute would be quite an extraordinary step, unquote. Trump is accused of intentionally holding on to some of the nation's most sensitive documents at Mar-a-Lago, only returning a fraction of them upon demand by the National Archives. Prosecutors say he urged his lawyer to hide records and to lie to the FBI by saying he no longer was in possession of them and enlisted staff to delete surveillance footage that would show boxes of documents being moved around the property. Cannon suggested in the past that she sees Trump's status as a former president as distinguishing him from others who have held on to classified records. After the Trump team sued the Justice Department in 2022 to get his records back, Cannon appointed a special master to conduct an independent review of the documents taken during the FBI's Mar-a-Lago search. That appointment was later overturned by a federal appeals court. On Thursday, she wrestled with the unprecedented nature of the case, noted that no former president has ever faced criminal jeopardy for mishandling classified information. But Bratt responded, quote, There was never a situation remotely similar to this one, unquote. Lawmaker pulls bill critics say imperils fertilization treatments. Story written by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline, Des Moines. In vitro fertilization's future in Iowa will not face legal uncertainty after all, at least for the moment. A legislative proposal from State House Republicans to increase criminal penalties when an individual causes the termination of a pregnancy without the mother's consent, a proposal that also amended state law in a way that critics warned would endanger fertility treatments like in vitro fertilization, will no longer be considered by state lawmakers this year, a key legislator said on Wednesday. Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale and chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said he did not advance the legislation specifically because of questions about its potential impact on in vitro fertilization. Quote, "I would say this. There was some definite concerns about in vitro fertilization and the negative effects and unintended consequences with that bill. And that was a very problematic for myself," Zahn told reporters after Wednesday's committee meeting. "And so that's why I pulled the bill," unquote. With that action, the bill essentially is ineligible for consideration for the remainder of the 2024 legislative session. However, legislative leaders in the majority party, which in both chambers of the legislature is Republicans, have tools and tricks at their disposal to resurrect any, quote, dead bills if they choose. In vitro fertilization is a fertility treatment by which a woman's egg is combined with a man's sperm in a medical lab, and then those embryos are placed in the woman's uterus. Critics have warned the proposed legislation could have made IVF illegal because of, as part of the process, extra embryos are sometimes frozen, stored, or discarded. They argued the bill does not sufficiently exempt fertility treatments. During debate in the Iowa House, Republicans insisted the bill, House File 2575, would not impact fertility treatments, and that its focus specifically was on the crime of non-consensual termination of a pregnancy. The bill passed out of the House on a 58-36 vote, with only Republicans supporting it. On Wednesday, Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, told reporters that House Republicans believed the bill would not have impacted fertility treatments, and that comparisons to issues that have arisen after an Alabama Supreme Court ruling in that state are not applicable to Iowa because of differences in the state's constitutions. The Alabama Supreme Court ruled last month that frozen embryos can be considered children under state law. Alabama legislators facing pushback after treatments were stopped at some of the state's largest fertility clinics, rushed to pass a bill this month, shielding doctors from legal liability because of the court opinion. Holt said that he understood the concerns raised about the Iowa's bill's potential impact. Quote, "I understand the concerns about IVF," Holt said. Quote, "We did not necessarily believe that there was an issue related to IVF, but I understand the concerns there. I believe life begins at conception. I also think we have to come to terms with how we're going to deal with the IVF issue. So I understand the concerns there," unquote. Bill that allows bypassing state auditor flounders in committee. This story comes to us from the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, and Dateline is Des Moines. A bill that would allow state agencies to bypass the state auditor's office by hiring private accountants to conduct annual audits was shelved on Wednesday ahead of a key legislative deadline. The House State Government Committee opted not to advance Senate File 2311, making it unlikely it will become law this year. The bill passed the Senate 31-16 last month. Representative June Bloomingdale, a Republican from Northwood, who chairs the committee, said committee members had too many concerns about the potential added costs created by the bill. A fiscal note from the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency found that hiring a private CPA firm could cost up to more than 3 times as much as using staff from the state auditor's office. Quote, "It was just something the committee couldn't get behind," Bloomingdale said, adding, "There's not support to move the bill forward in the House." Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand, the lone Democrat elected to statewide office in Iowa, said in a statement, House Republicans' tabling of the bill, quote, "is a welcome development that respects the will of voters and won't waste taxpayer money," unquote. Sand and legislative Democrats say the bill kneecaps Sand's authority as auditor and opens the door to political corruption by allowing government officials to bypass the state auditor for annual audits. Republican supporters of the bill argue the hiring of a private accountant to conduct a required annual audit already is allowed and widely employed by local governments and school districts. A recent Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll shows a majority of Iowans oppose the measure. Quote, "We thank those legislators who joined the majority of Iowans who opposed the bill," Sand said. Perry Tyson plant closing. Democratic state lawmakers in the Iowa Senate are urging the Iowa legislature and Governor Kim Reynolds to take action to help residents of Perry to deal with the recently announced closing of Tyson Foods pork plant there, which will result in the elimination of roughly 1,200 jobs. Democrats also criticized recent Republican-approved changes to the state's unemployment benefits program, which reduced the amount of time that individuals can receive benefits by nearly 3 months. The Tyson plant will close near the end of June. The Associated Press reported that Tyson will work with state and local officials to help workers who are losing their jobs, but the company did not say what severance packages it will offer. Multiple Iowa Senate Democrats spoke on the floor Wednesday, calling on Reynolds to release emergency funding to help Tyson workers remain in Perry while finding a new job and for Tyson to offer Perry workers a severance package. Iowa Senator Bill Dotzler, a Democrat from Waterloo, criticized the reduction in state unemployment benefits that State House Republicans approved in 2020. Dotzler noted that at the time, Senate Democrats offered an amendment that would have kept the longer benefits eligibility in place for workers impacted by plant closures. Quote, "These benefits paid to workers also help small businesses in their town. They buy their goods, get their gas. They are a real engine of economic development in keeping small businesses alive in Perry," Dotzler said. Quote, "And now, thanks to your actions, they're going to lose nearly 3 months' worth of benefits. That's going to affect the community in a very negative way," unquote. A spokesman for the Iowa Workforce Development said the State Department will be working with Tyson to assist workers impacted by the Perry's plant closure, including the deployment of the agency's new mobile workforce center. In a statement, Republican Senator Jason Schultz of Schleswig said Republicans' recent unemployment changes have been a success in getting Iowans back into the workforce. He noted that there are more than 13,000 job openings in central Iowa, saying he is optimistic that the affected Perry workers will be able to find new work. Quote, "Plant closing and job losses are traumatic experience for employees affected by the closing, their families, and the entire community," Schultz said. Quote, "Iowa Workforce Development and Tyson are both fully engaged in finding new employment for the impacted workers in Perry," unquote. Tax on hemp products proposed. Sales of hemp-derived CBD and THC products in Iowa could carry a 25% tax under a bill Senate lawmakers advanced on Wednesday. Senate Study Bill 3186 is intended to put intoxicating THC drinks and other products on the same level as alcohol, which is subject to attacks from the state's Alcoholic Beverages Division and Senator Dan Dawson, Republican from Council Bluffs, who led a subcommittee on the bill. Quote, "It's not fair in this state to have these distributors paying a 7% sales tax on these products, meaning if you're brewing or selling beer, you've got to run it through ABD's state warehouse," he said. "The tax disparity is all off on these issues," unquote. Products containing THC, legal under federal and state hemp regulation laws, are sold at some shops and bars across Iowa and cause similar psychoactive effects to traditional marijuana. The bill would go beyond THC and impose the same tax rate on non-psychoactive CBD and other consumable hemp product sold in Iowa. Owners of shops that sell CBD told lawmakers on Wednesday the bill would punish those stores that are selling products that are used for therapeutic reasons and do not cause intoxication. They said the bill should be written more narrowly to target high THC products. State lawmakers are also looking to regulate the THC content of hemp products. House lawmakers passed a bill this week to cap the potency of hemp products at 4 milligrams of THC per serving and 10 milligrams per package. Drug pricing bill passed. Iowa lawmakers passed a bill 93-3 Tuesday aimed at reining in prescription drug pricing practices that have forced small independent and rural Iowa pharmacies to close. House File 2401 would prohibit pharmacy benefit managers from charging an insurer more than they pay a pharmacy to dispense a medication. The practice is referred to as spread pricing, and where the pharmacy benefit manager keeps the spread or difference as profit. Instead, the bill would require PBMs to contract based on a pass-through pricing model, meaning PBMs could not pay pharmacies less than they charge the insurers that contract with them. Pharmacy benefit managers, known as PBMs, are third-party companies that function as intermediaries between insurance providers and drug manufacturers. The multi-billion dollar companies play a major role in negotiating drug prices and reimbursements for pharmacies. Lawmakers said the bill would aid rural and independent community pharmacies that have struggled because of PBM practices. Pharmacies across Iowa have closed at an alarming rate over the past decade plus, partly because insurance payouts don't cover drug costs. Independent pharmacies rely on pharmacy benefit managers so they can take various insurance plans, but those companies also decide how much money the pharmacists receive when reimbursing them. Pharmacists have said they are selling many common brand-name prescriptions at a loss because PBMs reimburse them less than the pharmacy's cost to acquire the drug. Quote, "At one time, Iowa counties had a minimum of 2 pharmacies. Now, we're down to 54 of 99 counties having at least 2 pharmacies," bill manager Representative Shannon Lundgren, Republican from Piasta, said in her closing comments on the House floor on Tuesday. Quote, "It's time to take some bold action to stop the unfair treatment of our local pharmacies," unquote. The House-passed bill also requires PBMs to create a process by which pharmacies can appeal the maximum allowable reimbursement paid to a pharmacy for a particular generic drug or a brand name drug that have generic versions available from multiple manufacturers and sold at different prices. The legislation would also prohibit retaliation by a PBM against a pharmacy or pharmacist for filing a complaint with the state insurance division by not renewing its contract with said pharmacy. Now, in college women's basketball, Wartburg College loses in overtime in Division III National Semifinal. Story written by Jim Nelson. Dateline is Columbus, Ohio. Smith College outscored Wartburg College 13-6 in overtime as the Pioneers pulled away for a 61-54 victory over the Knights in Women's Division III National Semifinal on Thursday. After Jaden Murphy hit a free throw with 1 minute 34 seconds left in overtime to tie the game at 51-all, Smith scored the next 8 points. Ali Yamada's sixth three-pointer of the game gave the Pioneers the lead for good with 1 minute 17 seconds left. Yamada led all scorers with 24 points, and it was teammate Jesse Raffner's and one that, with 39 seconds left, that buried the Knights, 29-3, into a hole it could not overcome. Ruffner finished with 22 points and 14 rebounds for the Pioneers. Despite out-rebounding Smith, 44-33, Wartburg could not overcome 17 turnovers. The Knights led by 4 at halftime, 22-18, but Smith started quickly with the first 5 points of the third quarter, surged into the biggest lead of the game to that point, which was 30-24. The Pioneers led 35-31 at the start of the fourth and led 37-31 with 7 minutes 23 left in the game. The game was the Knights' third appearance in the Final Four since 2016. New 24-hour diner to take the place of former University Avenue Perkins. Story written by Maria Cooper. Dateline Waterloo. After 4 years sitting empty, the former Perkins on University Avenue will be home of a new 24-hour diner. Mike's Diner, 3280 University Avenue, is set to open at the beginning of March. Owner Mike Newell hopes to serve the community all-American comfort food. Newell began looking at the property in November. Perkins closed in January of 2020 after the parent company filed for bankruptcy. Other contributing factors were major reconstruction of University Avenue at the time and ongoing management issues at the restaurant. It said people drive by to ask him what's going on with the building, as window overhangs spell out Mike's, and the Perkins letterboard states the diner will open soon. The idea of keeping the space as a diner came because Noel believes people in the Cedar Valley just want good food, a good price, and a clean atmosphere. Customers will be able to order breakfast all day, Noel said. A breakfast platter, which would include eggs, meat, and some type of pancake, waffle, or toast, will cost $8.99. Other breakfast items include skillets, omelets, breakfast sandwiches, waffles, pancakes, and French toast. The menu also will include lunch and dinner favorites, such as burgers, chicken, tenderloins, and patty melts, Reubens, French dips, casseroles, meatballs, soup and fish and chips. Baked goods and pies will also be available. Noel believes the location will serve up nostalgia for its customers. After hearing stories of fond memories from community members, the decision to buy the building was solidified. Some of the most meaningful comments came from University of Northern Iowa football players who helped him move equipment. The restaurant will have 28 booths and tables and hold around 150 people. He estimates it will have about 50 employees. Anyone wanting to apply can stop into the restaurant. And now, listeners, we just want to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, March 15th on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
I might not know you, but I still care about you. So if you feel hopeless or if you've been thinking about suicide, please talk to someone. A friend, parent, teacher, or coworker. If you can't talk to them or feel like you have no one there to listen, turn to Your Life Iowa. Things can get better. There are people who want to help you. Please reach out now at yourlifeiowa.org. Brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now, we turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial was published in the Storm Lake Times Pilot and was written by Rick Moraine. The title is The Heart and the Mind. I had a heart attack a few weeks ago. All is well. That Tuesday night, about 7 p.m., I was sitting at the press table at the Jefferson City Council meeting, taking notes, when my chest started to hurt. I figured it was probably acid reflux, which I have from time to time, so I waited for it to go away. It didn't. It hung around after the meeting adjourned at 8 p.m., so when I got home, I told Kathy that if it didn't disappear by 9:30, I would go to the emergency room at Greene County Medical Center to have it checked out. It was still there at 9 p.m., so I moved my deadline up and we drove to the ER. They did some lab testing and an electrocardiogram and pronounced the cause to be, sure enough, a heart attack. They gave me morphine and nitroglycerin to stop the pain. That was totally effective. And about midnight, sent Kathy and me to Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames in an ambulance. At Mary Greeley, they did more lab work and an angiogram, and then sent me by ambulance to Mercy One Hospital in downtown Des Moines late Wednesday afternoon. Son David drove to Ames Wednesday afternoon and brought Kathy back to Jefferson. She stayed overnight at our house and then drove to Des Moines Thursday morning, where she and David stood watch in my room. Another angiogram, this one at Mercy One, specified the problem. 4 mostly blocked coronary arteries, all on the left side of my heart. Consultation between my Ames cardiologist and a pair of Mercy One cardiologists developed the plan. One of the Des Moines doctors was a stent specialist, and he would insert stent wires up from both sides of my groin into my heart. He would then place metal stents into the arteries to open them up. The second Des Moines doctor, a cardiothoracic surgeon, would take over with the coronary bypass procedures if the stenting proved too difficult to do. The hospital described the situation as high risk. I didn't know exactly what that meant. It didn't sound like a walk in the park. But everything turned out all right. The 3-hour stenting of the 4 plaque-filled arteries took place Thursday morning and went perfectly smoothly. My brother Bill, a reconstructive surgeon living in Lamoni, drove up to Des Moines to keep me company. After a stay in the recovery room to let the groin insertion wounds heal, I was wheeled back up to my 6th-floor hospital room for a Thursday overnight stay and a welcome meal. We drove home mid-afternoon on Friday, and I feel great. I learned a lot about my heart from the 3-day event. For one thing, it's 82 years old, so some plaque buildup isn't all that unusual. In addition, a family history of heart difficulties adds to the likelihood of trouble. My dad had a heart attack at about age 85, and my mom died of an aortic aneurysm at age 76. What's more, I like all the wrong kinds of food, and that has to change. Finally, I'd rather lie on my couch than exercise, and that's going to change too. Specialists in matters of the heart are amazing. They know exactly what to do and or have a plan B in place just in case, which means they can successfully open up or bypass blockages in a person's circulatory system. Keeping passages clear is an essential procedure in another vital organ of the human body as well. That would be the brain. And the specialists who should make these decisions? Those would be teachers. I wouldn't want legislators telling cardiologists what procedures they should use to keep arteries clear. And I don't think legislators have the expertise to tell education specialists how to keep young minds open. That's what teachers have gone to college for. They've learned methodologies they can use to maintain clear passages in the mind where ideas can circulate freely. Clogging up young minds with material that's been pre-approved on a legislative floor and forbidding the teaching of certain established facts erect barriers to learning and thoughtful analysis in a way similar to what plaque does to coronary arteries. Both cardiologists and teachers should be able to ply their trades free of untutored interference from lawmakers, whether well-intentioned or not. I'm enormously grateful to the specialists who were free to open up my old heart arteries last week. I feel the same way about teachers who did that for my young brain many decades ago. Next, from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Republicans draw up a destructive blueprint for public universities. This was written by Lucas Grundmeier on behalf of the Register's editorial board. In less than 24 hours, on the last 2 days of February, the Iowa House approved bills that would put anti-abortion propaganda in schools, institute a social studies curriculum focused on, quote, the United States' exceptional and praiseworthy history, unquote, would allow teachers to have guns at school, and foster chaos in the vital services provided by area education agencies. Those attempts to transform how K-12 schools operate might have stolen some of the attention that is due another bill that passed the House on February 29th. House File 2558, styled the Higher Education Reform Act of 2024, is a sweeping bill affecting the three state universities' financing, organization, and oversight. It's also hyperbolic and paternalistic, with tactics akin to lobbing hand grenades to try to weed our backyard garden. For the bill to remain alive for consideration this year, the Iowa Senate Education Committee needs to approve the bill this week. Senators should let it die. Tuition freeze plan leaves too much unsaid. Some of the bill's provisions could be called solutions in search of problems, but that can't be said of provisions to make college costs more predictable for families. Tuition alone at Iowa State University has risen 236% since the year 2001. Inflation in that period is 73%. Iowa students have some of the worst loan debt burdens in the nation. Under the bill, Iowa residents would pay the same tuition and fees for 4 years once they start attending. New students could not be charged more than 3% above the tuition and fee total from the previous year. That's a fine target. But the bill leaves for another day any indication of how universities would balance their budgets, other than shedding degree programs and employees. The state's direct support to universities has been dropping for decades. In 2005, the state covered nearly half of their general education funds. That figure is now below 30%. While lawmakers won't begin work in earnest on the 2024-25 budget until after the March 15th Revenue Estimating Conference meeting, a sizable bump in higher education appropriations would be a when pigs fly level of surprise, regardless of whether tuition limits become law. Nonpartisan analysts said it was difficult to predict the bill's fiscal impact, but noted that if such a policy had been instituted before fall 2020, and all else remained equal, Iowa State, the University of Iowa, and University of Northern Iowa would have lost a cumulative $28 million compared with the tuition increases that actually took place. The bill, quote, does not do anything to backfill that money, said Representative Jennifer Confirst, a Windsor Heights Democrat who teaches at Drake University. Tuition is worthy of Iowa lawmakers' attention, but artificially capping increases and doing nothing else is an incomplete solution, like the state's new clampdown on property tax revenue that has cities, counties, and school districts fretting about not being able to keep up with expenses. Republicans can't shake their fixation on DEI. This bill probably would not be around if not for some Republicans' fixation on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, or DEI, as a paramount threat to Iowans. Quote, "They are now ideological enforcement centers that suppress the pursuit of truth and, most importantly, merit," said State Representative Taylor Collins, a Minneapolis Republican. He declared to wrap up the debate on February 29th. At least he can't be accused of beating around the bush. The bill would demand that DEI jobs and work be limited only to what's required by civil rights laws or other statutes. Occasional excesses in DEI programming and spending across the nation have been well documented and relentlessly amplified by political conservatives. Collins's response, at the very least, throws out the baby with the bathwater and ignores widespread support among young people for DEI. It's reminiscent of Governor Kim Reynolds's insistence that the best way to handle a few mediocre test scores for Iowans receiving a special education service is to dismantle those services and start over. The DEI portion of the higher education bill is also redundant. Under pressure from Republican lawmakers, the Board of Regents is already well down the path of reducing DEI programs in the same way the bill prescribes, right down to a prohibition on requiring people to disclose their preferred pronouns. Whether or not those changes become law, the universities and their students are already worse off for having these resources curtailed. Other ideas range from decent to pointless. Republicans' desire to micromanage the universities and public community colleges is so broad that the rest of the bill is best dealt with in bullet point form. And listeners, here are those bullet points. The bill would add a number of guardrails on hiring of administrators. Board of Regents staff in February asserted that the Iowa system has the second lowest rate of administrative costs in the nation. To be fair to lawmakers, state-to-state comparisons of such education data can be colored by many variables, but trying to legislate away bloat seems heavy-handed regardless. And the bill has some decent, if not revolutionary, ideas. Universities would be required to focus on producing workers for high-demand fields, set up new work-study programs, and write up proposals for getting a degree in about 3 years' worth of work instead of four. They also would need to spend the rest of 2024 studying ways to cut costs. And the last bullet, other proposals are wholly needless. One would bar faculty governance of the universities and community colleges. Another, vaguely cautious about faculty separating personal political advocacy from work. Still another would add two non-voting legislators to the Board of Regents, a move that would exacerbate the board's partisan imbalance. The nine members before Dr. Michael Richards' February resignation included five Republicans and one Democrat, and the proposed non-voting members would be appointed by the majority party in each legislative chamber. And finally, the bill would require institutions to consider the classic learning test in addition to the ACT and SAT. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has touted the test, but critics say that its backers are overwhelmingly partisan conservatives and that its content in math doesn't measure up to the other admissions tests' standards. The bill is responding to a caricature. Even given each of these ideas the benefit of the doubt, they should not be considered in an omnibus package. Tuition plans should be considered separately and in conjunction with appropriations, and the other ideas should either be tossed aside completely or taken up one by one. Democrats in the House unanimously opposed the bill, and six Republicans joined them. Collins, the floor manager, said that Americans don't trust higher education institutions, pointing to the trend in a Gallup survey. But that poll has found declining trust in over a dozen American institutions, and it tells us nothing about Iowa specifically. House File 2558 is an answer to a caricature of Iowa's public universities. Lawmakers should instead deal in facts and get more grounded assessments of complicated topics before overhauling state law. They can get started on that once they kill this misguided bill. The next editorial is titled, What's the Matter with Me? It's written by the Storm Lake Times Pilot's editor, Art Cullen. People have been telling us country bumpkins for a long time what's wrong with us. After a while, you begin to believe it. Quote, what's the matter with Kansas? William Allen White of the Emporia Gazette famously asked as William Jennings Bryan and the populists challenged the railroads and White's mercantile class. White became the sage of the prairie and friend of Teddy Roosevelt by telling the rural riffraff to let the folks in Emporia, Topeka, New York, and Washington determine their interests. What's the matter with Kansas? Thomas Frank asked by title of his 2004 book that pondered why these rural folks vote against their seeming self-interest. Lately, the authors of a book called White Rural Rage suggest that we, especially we men, are an imminent threat to democracy. What about Governor Kim Reynolds, city boys? Paul Waldman was a columnist for the Washington Post. Thomas Schaller was a columnist for the Baltimore Sun. They argue that our festering, irrational rage will vault Trump back into power. Then you have Paul Krugman, columnist for the New York Times, musing that the rural voter is a mystery. Trump is our fault. We're racist. Okay, I was born and grew up in Storm Lake, Iowa, white and rural. Hog Central. I know what I've seen, basically, since the Reagan Revolution. Half as many family farms, the elimination of the independent pork producer, the union busted, wages half as much in real terms. Coast to Coast left downtown Lake Avenue after Walmart moved in. Where Walmart isn't in smaller towns, Dollar General is. Storm Lake is better off than the rest of rural Iowa. We're growing, thanks to immigration. That's not so in two-thirds of Iowa. They tore down the school in Fonda, and the main street is about to fall down in Pomeroy. It must be us who did this to us, our racism and what have you. Despite the fact that Iowa twice voted for Barack Obama. Manufacturing, coincidentally, tanked after Wall Street declared us dead in 2008. River towns emptied out, and the voters left behind swung to Trump. How could that happen? How could people vote for Steve King? Trump said he would drain the swamp, the elite, the power structure, the people who sneer at us hayseeds. Quote, I am your retribution. They think we are ignorant. King was right when he said that wealth flows from the land and that we were getting screwed. He went too far in his comments on race, especially. He couldn't shut up. White Republican voters in rural Northwest Iowa, spurred by the corporate establishment, got rid of him in a primary. Representative Randy Feenstra more politely represents the money that's always run things. Sinclair Broadcasting owns the airwaves. The bar has Fox News on TV. Facebook fills in the misinformation gaps. One of our oldest voices of moderation, the Centerville Iowegian, shut down along with so many other weekly newspapers. You are led to believe that somebody stole the farm and the Mexicans stole your job. And nobody is there to say otherwise. The Democrats don't bother along the back roads. They think rural people are too stupid and wrapped up in cultural grievance to notice. The more they think that way, the more they enhance Trump's chances. Trump's chances are pretty decent, the polls say. A sure way to win is to assume that people in Buena Vista County cannot possibly know what is in their interest. Deplorable. What brilliant politics to tell me that I must be an idiot because I am a rural white man who believes that the Farm Bill has become a welfare vehicle for agri-industry. How ingenuous to ignore Latinos in meatpacking towns as if they do not exist. There are three or four chemical companies, meatpackers, book publishers, and news outlets that control the food you eat and the messages that are stuffed down your throat. They want you to believe that somebody in Nemaha is a threat to democracy, but Goldman Sachs and the Koch network are benign business interests. The thing about growing up rural and stupid like us, that you depend on your instincts and senses, especially your nose, to know when you're being served up a plate of bull garnished with sophistry. Now, from the Storm Lake Times pilot editor Art Cullen, re-elect Biden. President Joe Biden's State of the Union address last week became his first big campaign speech, with Super Tuesday fresh in his wake and the November straight ahead. That's okay, because the union has unfinished business to bury Donald Trump politically for the sake of democracy, freedom, and the rule of law. On that score, Biden did well. He made it evident that he is up for the fight. Our choice is set, Biden or Trump. Unquestionably, Biden. The facts already are in. Trump was the most repugnant and corrupt president in our history. He tried to overthrow democracy. He stole classified documents of the most sensitive nature and refused to return them on first call. He has been found by a jury to have committed sexual assault. A New York court found that he committed $450 million worth of fraud. He remains under indictment in state and federal court on more than 90 charges. Attempts by Republicans to find dirt on Biden have yielded nothing. Senator Chuck Grassley's star witness is a Russian thug sitting in a federal pen, accused of fraud. Joe Biden's son, Hunter, is guilty of being a recovering cokehead with a gun who failed to pay taxes. The sins of the son are not those of the father. Joe Biden is as decent of a man as you could realistically wish in the Oval Office. He is old, but he is probably in better shape than Trump. Biden certainly has less bile. He is not malicious. He does not live by retribution. Biden disappoints. He could not corral stray Democrats in the Senate when it mattered on child tax credits, for example, the single most effective way to lift entire families out of poverty. He has not advocated for our immigrant neighbors as he said he would. He is willing to compromise with know-nothings in order to break the logjam over immigration that bedevils us. Trump and the House Freedom Caucus are beyond compromise. They want to rule by fiat. That is what this election boils down to. Biden should hammer the GOP for refusing everything they previously asked for in a border deal. We need to move forward. Our immigration, climate, food security, and affordability, and bringing rural America into prosperity enjoyed on the coasts. We have expressed our frustration with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack over the pace and course of change, while acknowledging that few people are better suited for the job. Iowa certainly can do no better. At least Vilsack will listen and argue with you about it. Vilsack has put a priority on climate-smart agriculture, but he is funneling the money through the corporate players, who get plenty before any of it reaches Buena Vista County. Vilsack's predecessor, Sonny Perdue, was deaf to the concerns of Storm Lake as food workers keeled over amid COVID. Iowa just notched two of its best years ever for net farm income. Land recently sold in Sioux County for $27,000 per acre. If you were the losing bidder flush with cash, you could complain about inflation. Still, Trump is favored to win in Iowa. The latest Iowa poll published by the Des Moines Register shows him with a 15% lead over Biden. That speaks to how Biden and the Democratic Party have abandoned Iowa. They believe it is irretrievably lost. It will be if nobody asks us for our vote. Barack Obama won by knocking on mobile home doors in Storm Lake. We haven't seen the like since. Tom Vilsack has won Iowa. He knows how. You have to try. For all those reasons, the practical choice is Joe Biden for president. He also is the right choice for some modicum of honesty, civility, and respect for the law. Now, back to local news from the Courier. Deere will lay off 150 workers in Ankeny. This written by Courier staff. Dateline Ankeny. Deere and Company will lay off 150 production employees at the John Deere Des Moines Works in Ankeny. According to multiple reports, Deere corporate offices in Moline, Illinois, have confirmed 150 workers at the facility were notified Friday about an indefinite layoff effective over April and May. Quote, each John Deere factory balances the size of its production workforce with the needs of the individual factory to optimize the workforce at each facility, the company said in a statement. John Deere says its Ankeny facility currently has about 1,700 employees, and 1,136 of them work in production and maintenance roles. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, March 15th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.